I'd like to call the Resources Committee meeting to order at 1 p.m. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. Members present, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tellerico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Delana Johnson, our Vice Chair, Representative Dean Westlake, my Co-Chair, Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I want to start out by thanking the wonderful staff. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Deborah Tillinghast, and our LIO moderators, Ben Manley and Summers Cole. They're going to be of great assistance to us through our meetings this session. They'll be joining us during our committee meetings to ensure we have accurate minutes, clear audio and video, and smooth telephonic testimony. I want to introduce my committee aide, Thatcher Brower. We'll get to know him very well, I'm sure, throughout this session. I'm going to turn it over to Representative Josephson to introduce his committee aide.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Good afternoon, everybody. It's been an exciting new year, and it's my pleasure to introduce Megan Rowe. She will be my committee aide, and some of you may recall she was my aide last year working on the tax credit issue.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. I want to start this first House Resources Committee meeting by asking each member to introduce themselves. Tell us what district you represent and if there's any resource development in your district that you'd like to share so we are knowledgeable about the issues in your area. And we can start here with Representative Birch.
You bet. Chris Birch, I represent the good citizens in South Anchorage. Actually, the center point of our district is the Alaska Zoo. I don't know that that's particularly indicative of our overall district, but it's a fairly concise district in South Anchorage. We have, as far as resource development, a lot of interest and engagement there, a lot of residents that work in the resource side. I personally am a graduate mining engineer out of the University of Alaska in Fairbanks and a registered civil, and have worked in the resource development side for a number of years, and appreciate the afternoon engagement here and the briefing, and looking forward to working with each of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome. Representative Parrish.
I'm Justin Parrish, representing the Juneau Valley Airport area, Auk Bay, and Out the Road. And we are fortunate enough to have two major mines in the larger Juneau area.
Thank you. Representative Tellerico.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dave Tellerico. I represent House District 6, which I always refer to as the eastern half of Alaska. Resource development in my area is very substantial. Within the district, two of the largest six operating mines in the state, large scale, are there. Usabelli Coal Mine is located in Healy. Fort Knox Gold Mine is located north of Fairbanks, up on the Elliott Highway. Also in my district is the Taylor Highway, and the 40-mile mining district is within the district. And up in the Central and Circle area, there are some miners. There are some historical mining areas in Ferry, Alaska. One of the old historical mines, Liberty Bell Mine. There's actually some mining going on there, and in the Totatlanika River. There's also some exploratory drilling going on right now. I'm kind of borrowing that from somebody else's district, but a lot of the shareholders from an area that we share down there are drilling down in the Glen Allen area, and I think it will expand into District 6, as well as out near Nenana, where Doyon is currently pursuing gas and oil development out there and doing some exploratory drilling. So there is a lot of resource activity there. We're also pretty well known for our fish and game activity in the area, more so game than fish. So it's a very popular recreational area as well. A lot of hunting guides operate in Unit 20 as well. So we're very fortunate that we're very diverse. We have military installations as well, but we are also a very resource-rich area of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll come around. We'll come back. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you very much. Representative Rauscher, District 9. District 9 is a compliment to the representative on the other side of the Richardson Highway. We're kind of a complement in a lot of respects out there. We have a lot of things in common. The pipeline is very well, as you know, runs right down the entire northwest side to the lower south side of the district. Into Valdez. We've got two seaports, so fishing is a big resource. We have mines, we have coal mines, we have gold mines, as you know, we have Pogo mine, we have Wishbone mine, we have Middle Earth is sitting there, and they're looking for gas right now. They're trying to see what they can do in that direction. There's, I just believe there's a wealth of resources, and it's a very important integral part of the state of Alaska, and I hope to represent it well. I'm looking forward to this year and working with everybody here in this committee, as well as all of you here which have come to speak to us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Madam Co-Chair. Is it Madam Co-Chair?
Madam That's Co-Chair.
Kind of mouthy. I represent Spinard and Midtown Anchorage, one of the most compact districts in the state. We don't have exactly a lot of natural resources unless you count a number of alcohol and marijuana licenses, but those are sprouting like crazy. There are some grow operations actually in Spinard and manufacturing operations, but I'm actually quite interested in the agriculture aspects of what we do in this committee. I'm interested in food security for all of our citizens in Alaska, and I've been on all the farm tours of the Mat-Su Burrow in the last several years, and really enjoyed learning about what we grow and what we can eat, and maybe what we can export in terms of things done in Fairbanks, like the peonies and that kind of stuff. But on the agriculture side, I'm really interested in. When we open a mine in Spinard, I'll let you know.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Representative Johnson.
So I'm Representative Johnson, Delana Johnson, and I represent the greater Palmer area, which is District 11. We don't have a lot of mines right in our area, but we certainly have some growing concerns within my district. But we are the gateway to Wishbone Mine. It's just Wishbone Hill for coal. It's just right outside of our district. That's why the railroad goes through Palmer, was because of resource development. We have had timber cutting in our district in the past, but our biggest thing, of course, is we have a lot of people that work throughout the state in resources. People love living in the Mat-Su Valley. But I also have, and I'm pleased to see someone from Palmer here today, from representing the agricultural community and department. Arthur Keyes is here, and agriculture is our growing concern, and we've always been known from the inception of even in the territory that the Matanuska Valley is the place where crops are grown, and that's where our food is. If we would have security, that would where we would be growing most of it. So we'll be talking much about agriculture in this committee, I hope.
Me too. Thank you, Representative. Mr. Vice Chair.
Hello. District 40, Northern Alaska. It's huge. We have jade. We have gold. We have silver. We have lead. We have copper. We have coal. And we have, of course, the oil and gas. So it's all-encompassing.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you know, my district is generally safe to walk across in about a 90-minute period. I think someone could lose their life walking across either stumbling into a violent stream or running into an equally violent bear. But my district is, of course, a human capital, human resources district. It does have Alyeska Pipeline in it. Across the street is the BP building. We have a new $100 million engineering building in on the UA campus, which is the heart of my district. So there's a lot of sort of intellectual capital, I guess, is prominent.
Thank you. And myself, Representative Garantar, I represent also Compact Anchorage District. I have the proud distinction of representing the most diverse neighborhood in the United States in Mountain View, so I love to mention that when I get the opportunity. And like some others, I'm a botanist by training, so have a lot of interest in agriculture and think there's great opportunity there, and we'll be working to promote Alaska Grown and more agricultural opportunities, and have folks that work in the fishing industry. It's our largest private sector employer, and want to make sure more Alaskans are getting those jobs, so I have a lot of interest in that. And then, of course, benefit from the natural resource wealth from our neighbors to the north and the east there, in the form of our annual dividend, as well as good-paying jobs. And I want to think in partnership with the Labor and Commerce Committee about what our future opportunities are and make sure that we're readying our workforce while we're also looking at our future of resource development. So those are some of my perspectives. And we have a really strong committee, lots of resource activity, and I think we'll all benefit from the knowledge that you can bring to this committee and helping us understand what's going on in your areas and how we can do a good job managing our resources and meeting our constitutional mandate of maximizing the value of those important resources for our citizens. Representative Parrish, did you have a question or comment?
No, I just realized that I neglected to mention our small farmers here in Juneau, our fisheries and game and timber opportunities.
Thank you. Not to leave Southeast out. Well, just before we get started in our presentation today, I just want to take a moment for a few of those housekeeping items. First of all, we want to remind members to please silence your cell phones. And if you should have that unfortunate event where your cell phone rings, there's a little treat you need to bring for the committee the next time. It's been donuts, or perhaps if we're on a healthier agriculture kick here, we can bring some Alaska Grown carrots or something. But please do silence your cell phones to help us get our committee work done. Members should have received a couple of memos from the co-chairs. We wanted to make sure that you know about our amendment process. What we'd like to do is be working on a couple of bills simultaneously, and as we set one bill aside, have a period of time that would allow you to work with that bill sponsor, get questions answered from the department, and then we'd ask that amendments be in 24 hours before we're going to bring the bill back up before the committee. That way, members can come to a committee meeting prepared, have questions answered, and hopefully that will facilitate a very productive process. We use that same requirement in our meetings over the last couple of years, and I appreciated being able to see things and come in a little bit more knowledgeable. So that's the process we're going to use, and there's a memo outlining that. Second item is the bill hearing request. We're working to make sure it's consistent in House committees to ensure accuracy, fairness, and reduce confusion. So we'll have asked members to follow the outline. And this has been emailed to all members as well, of this committee, as well as all members in the legislature. And for those of us watching us online, please contact an office if you're, you know, interested in being supportive of a bill, and you can be a part of helping get that bill packet together by providing your letters of support and sending along any notes that would help us in consideration of that legislation. So on the committee hearing request and the amendments, want to make sure that seems clear to everyone before we move on. We're good there. Wonderful. Our committee aides are going to work with legislators and staff to ensure that you have the necessary documents to be prepared for committee. And we'd like to have a process where everything that's received in our offices by 5 p.m. the day before the committee will be on basis that day. Anything we receive in between then that evening and the next morning, we'll do one more upload at 10 a.m. And then anything that comes in after that will be hard copy available in the committee. So we'll try to do that. We'll encourage our folks to get things to us in a timely fashion, again, in the interest of you having an opportunity to review it before coming to committee. Hopefully that process will work, and nothing is set in stone, so if we find that we need to make adjustments, we're certainly flexible to that. Want to make sure that we remind everyone our scheduled meeting time is Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 1 to 3 p.m. here in the Barnes Room, room 124. We're working with our budget subcommittee chair, Representative David Guttenberg, to schedule our budget subcommittees. And what we are talking to do right now will be a combination of our committee meeting and the budget subcommittee meeting. And just to refresh everyone about how that process will work, our committee will be the budget subcommittee for the Department of Natural Resources. So we'll both be the policy committee and the budget subcommittee. We'll be joined by Representative David Guttenberg as the committee chair for budget deliberations. So at that point, the co-chairs will step back. We'll turn the gavel over to Representative Guttenberg. He'll chair those meetings. They'll be considered our budget subcommittee meetings. What we've discussed so far is that we will do that starting next week, the hour prior to this meeting. So on next Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, from 12 to 1, we'll start our budget subcommittee meetings, and we'll have the committee from 1 to 3. We understand that that does occur during the lunch hour, so we are going to ask members to bring food in and have it as a working lunch meeting. And that's because when you look at our schedule, we have about 11 weeks. That's 33 regularly scheduled meetings. We reserve the right and possibility of scheduling additional meetings, but we do have a lot of work to get done and a lot of important issues that we need to consider. So we're going to try that schedule at least during next week, and then hopefully that will work with everyone and we'll be able to get that work done.
Can I comment just on that with us?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think that this is pretty clearly experimental in some respects, but I think that for new members and new members to the legislature, you'll find that there will be a net gain in terms of hours that you'll have in your day. I think there were things to support the previous system where you would physically go to another room and you might sit on four or five subcommittees. You might still sort of sit on that many committees, but you won't be moving around and playing musical chairs as much. So this is really designed to streamline the process, and I hope it works well. And is we want to have ample time to deal with the complicated legislation we're going to have, and we didn't want the subcommittee process to cut into that too much. I think that was our part of the thinking, too. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we transition into our presentations for today, any comments or questions from members about those items we've just discussed? Okay. Our committee aides will be in close contact with your staff, and hopefully things will run smoothly. That's certainly our goal. So with that, we will go ahead and transition into the presentations from today. If I could please ask the commissioner to join us at the table, and if you have any support folks, lifeline folks that you want to bring up.
Yeah.
We are going to spend today's meeting as well as Friday's meeting with our department overview. We've given a lot of latitude to the department in terms of organizing the presentation. We asked them to, you know, give us an understanding of current status of work being going happening in each of the divisions, and just very high level whether they've recently experienced any budget cuts, where they're at sort of position-wise, but then saving the very detailed budget conversation for the meetings that will start next week. So, Commissioner Mack, welcome to our committee. It's wonderful to be able to welcome you for the first meeting we're having this year, joined by Deputy Commissioner Mark Wiggin and other Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles. Welcome you all, and please, when you start your testimony, state your name and put yourself on the record, and let us know if you'd like us to hold questions till the end or questions throughout, but please always direct questions through the chair as we go through the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Andy Mack. I'd like to start by congratulating everybody for volunteering for service. I have a number of people here who are with me, and I think the most important thing I can do to start out is to introduce the DNR team. We've got a number of people here, both in the room, and we have folks who are online, too. And just so everybody knows, these folks that I'm going to introduce are really the key staffers at the Department of Natural Resources. They are the Commissioner's Office staff and the division directors. So this will take a little bit, but please bear with me. I think it might be best if I started out online, and I have a couple of folks who are calling in from Fairbanks today. From Fairbanks, I've got Steve Masterman. Steve Masterman is the director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey. Steve is on the line. In addition, in Fairbanks, we have the director of the Division of Forestry, Chris Mache. And Chris is online. Out of the Anchorage area, we have a couple of directors. From the Office of Project Management, we have the director, Dr. Sarah Longan. And also in Anchorage, we have the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Brent Goodrum. We also have in the Anchorage office the Parks Director, Mr. Ben Ellis.
That's Ben Ellis.
Okay. So that's the folks who are online, and I wanted to make sure you knew they were there. There's five of them. And then I want to go around the room here so that everybody is familiar with the key folks here. So I'm just going to have to turn around briefly, Madam Chair, so that I don't miss anybody. We have the Executive Director of the Mental Health Trust Land Office, John Morrison, who is sitting here in the front row. We have the Director of the Division of Ag, Arthur Keyes, who is here. And we have the Director of Admin Services, Fabian Peter Contes. And then we have
Dana
Mackey with Admin Services. I'm sorry, Dana. And then over here we have the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Chantel Walsh. And so those are some of our key members. And we've kind of just made an executive decision on having a couple of key folks here who will help with the presentation here. And generally speaking, if they're in the room, they'll be helping with the presentation. The folks who are online are more than happy. They'll be giving part of the presentation to their divisions. And they will, like I say, be available online. We have one more member of the DNR team who is also online, too. His name is Stephen Wright. He's a DNR contractor who has been working for us with respect to the AKLNG project, if we get to that part of the program. So,
Commissioner, before you begin, the members of the committee may also want to be familiar with Ed King.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Your ledge liaison.
Yep, I apologize. Ed was hiding right behind Arthur there. Ed King is in the background there. We're very happy to have Ed in the room. Ed is got a dual role at DNR. He is both a special assistant and he's the ledge liaison. I'd like to talk a little bit about Ed and Mr. Wiggin and Mr. Fogles and kind of give you a little background on them. Ed King is a veteran. He actually was at one point stationed at Fort Wainwright, I believe, in Fairbanks. He has been an employee of the Department of Revenue. He also was an employee at DNR in the Division of Oil and Gas and is a commercial analyst. He's a great asset to our team, and you will necessarily hear some legislation this year on sale of royalty oil. You're going to hear some issues that come up with how we audit oil companies, and Ed is a tremendous resource, and that really is his background. I'd like to talk a little bit about my two deputy commissioners and give you some brief background on them. Mr. Fogles has had a wealth of experience working at DNR, both as a division director in the commissioner's office. He served a number of commissioners in a number of administrations and has a real in-depth knowledge of our department and some of the histories, some of the changes in organization as divisions were created, sometimes collapsed into one another, and is a real asset. And we're very happy that he's with us. On my left is Mr. Wiggin. Mr. Wiggin comes, one of the interesting things about the economy in the state of Alaska is there's been, we all know there's been some downshifts in the number of folks employed, both in the public and the private sector. We were very happy to bring Mark on board. He's an engineer by training. He's worked for 30 plus years in Alaska as an engineer and on some of the most high-profile projects in the oil business, and he's come on board, and he is currently the person who manages the oil and gas side of the DNR. And just so everybody knows, we have really two large sides to the DNR. One is really focused on oil and gas, and then the other side is focused on the other divisions, including mining, land and water, agriculture, parts and oil pump. So I look forward to you getting to know all these folks. We have a wonderfully talented team, and we are here to help provide information to explain what we do at DNR. It's a unbelievably fascinating place with many, many nooks and crannies, and it's really, you know, we'll do everything we can to give you information so that you can make decisions about the issues that come before you. So on slide one, Madam Chair, we have, or slide two, which is up in front of us here, we have four parts to our presentation today. Part one, and I want to talk about these and then make a suggestion. Part one is really just kind of a broad overview on the general resource base of Alaska, and many of you know the information that I will describe in the slides. But I think it's always a good reminder to talk about how many resources we have and the obligations and the responsibilities that we have, and to just kind of share a common understanding of all of our obligations and the issues that are going to come before this committee and the body. They're really quite impressive. The second part I really would like to spend a considerable amount of today's hearing on, and that is to introduce each of the divisions within DNR, and then to give the deputy commissioners, either Ed or Mark, and then the division directors a chance to talk for a handful of minutes about what they do and some of the things that they have been recently working on, and give a chance for the committee to ask questions, and that would be really significant. It might take up the rest of the 2 hours, and then part three is really to provide the committee with an update on where we stand with respect to the AKLNG project, and that might any of these topics could take an entire session, but that might be something for a second hearing or Friday's hearing, and then of course our 2017 priorities and activities. And I think once we get into the divisions, you'll realize that there's a lot of material. You know, the other thing I wanted to mention too, there's a lot of things that we didn't include in this. We spend a lot of time, for instance, asserting and maintaining the state's position relative to the federal government, for instance. And we spend a lot of time examining issues with respect to land management, and how we do that and how we are impacted by what the federal agencies are doing in areas where they control, whether it be a public land order, which has been issued and is in place, for instance, the TAPS corridor, or the NPRA, or the Eastern Interior Plan, or an issue like the Eisenbach Refuge, where we're trying to build a road. And that is not included in today's presentation, and I would highly recommend that we have another day when we get into a full presentation on just the issue of land. And it's there's more work there than we can ever possibly do. Alaskans, you know, I don't really know anybody who's in the resource development or conservation community that doesn't think about these issues, but it's not in this presentation. The other thing is we didn't really include a lot in here. We touch on some of the big development issues, whether it's a mine, whether it's oil and gas, but we don't go into any detail here. But we can certainly do that on another day. We can segregate oil and gas or oil out. We can segregate it into the North Slope and Cook Inlet if you want. And each one of these topics is extremely detailed. Again, AKLNG, we might be spending a considerable and separate amount of time. And broadly speaking, you know, there's a lot of opportunities, at least we feel, with respect to what is going on in the federal administration and how we handle those and manage those and how we go forward, and how we can be careful yet responsible stewards and active resource developers is a very important topic. But it's not really something that is included in this initial presentation. All right. So I'd like to go to slide number three, and I'm going to try to, but the clicker is not working right now. Nope, it's not working. For those online, one moment here. We're having some technical difficulties with the...
We'll take a brief break. So we're back to order here again at 1:31. Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So those online, we've got the slides working. We're on slide three. It's always important for us to start off with one of the most fundamental principles of Alaska, which is we have this incredible opportunity and responsibility to manage our land base and all of the things that come along with ownership. And we are incredibly fortunate. You know, we live in a state with 586,000 square miles. You all know this. We're larger than 18 sovereign nations. We have more coastline. We have 3 million lakes and approximately 40% of the nation's fresh water, which, by the way, fresh water is one of the biggest assets that DNR actually manages, and it's considerable. One of the things I mentioned in my opening is that at statehood, we were granted approximately 100 million acres of land. But in addition to the 100 million acres, the 105 million acres that you hear commonly, you need to add to that the tidelands, the shorelands, and the submerged lands. And when you do that, you add about 60 million acres to our portfolio. And it ends up being in excess of 160 million acres of area, including all those categories, uplands, tidelands, shorelands, and submerged lands. And when you realize that it is an area, by way of comparison, Oregon is 62 million acres. We're almost three times the land within Alaska, or three times the land that we manage, the area that we manage, is three times the size of Oregon. And it's not even a close call by comparison. The next largest state portfolio of land, I believe, is New York, with something like 11 million acres. So we are in this unbelievably unique and exciting spot. We always have been. And along with that comes these incredible, along with these obligations and these opportunities come these questions, and they persist, and DNR spends a lot of time thinking about them. But I think it's important just to know that the things that we do here in Alaska, the things that this committee does, are on a scale which is, literally 15 times greater than any other state in the country. And many states have only a handful of acres that they actually own. Most of it's in private ownership or federal ownership. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the resource potential in oil and gas. And again, this is something that, is discussed often, but it's worth discussing and just understanding the vastness of the resource that we are, in many cases, chasing, in some cases developing, and sometimes producing. But on the North Slope, there's more undiscovered, potentially recoverable oil than any other Arctic nation. There's an estimated 40 billion barrels of conventional oil. And that's not what I would refer to as the tight or shaley type oil or the heavy oil. That is stuff that you can produce and flows from conventional wells. 16 billion barrels of that is onshore, and that includes both state and federal land. And remember, we're talking about the North Slope. So to the east, there's the 1002. In the middle, central part of the North Slope is state-owned land, and then there's the NPRA. And 16 billion barrels is estimated to be under those lands. And then in the offshore, in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, there's an estimated 24 billion barrels of oil. And that entire topic of OCS and the potential to develop there and the decisions recently made by the federal government is, again, very complex, very detailed. We spend a lot of time thinking about it. I'm certainly happy to answer questions about it, but it's challenging to generate access to those areas, but it is something we work very, very hard on. As far as gas is concerned, there's an estimated over 200 trillion cubic feet of conventional natural gas. What's interesting about that is The premise of the LNG is that there's 24 T of gas in Prudhoe Bay, and there's about 8 T of gas at Point Thompson. Thus, they have this unbelievable source for that particular project, but understanding that is 32 T, and what the USGS estimates is there's 200 T across the North Slope of Alaska, which is just an unbelievable resource.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
As a newbie here, what's permissible? Do you roll through the whole presentation? Is it more conversation? Do we ask questions as it comes up, or do you want to accumulate them and roll them out later?
I'm happy to do it either way.
So if you're happy to do either way, I think you might as well ask the questions as we go, being mindful of the time. So I want to make sure everyone has time, but we'd be happy to entertain
any questions. You had 100 million acres of land in the prior slide. Are there any more land entitlements due to the state? And, is that – and how many acres to the nearest million is that?
We've selected about 100 million. There's about 5 million left to be selected. We've – patented title to about 60 million, and correct me if I'm wrong about that. About 60 million has been patented, and we, in other words, title is completely transferred. There's about 40 million which we have access to, but the challenge, and I apologize, Representative Birch to the chair, but the challenge is that in many cases there are linkages between what we want to do and federal enclaves that really tend to create barriers, and there's a whole bunch, and we can talk about the Eastern Interior Plan, we can talk about stuff that goes on up in the North Slope, but the broad numbers are, we have complete title to 60 million, we have selected and been, 40 million has been, what would the proper nomenclature be for?
Tentatively approved.
TA'd, tentatively approved, and about 5 million left of actual selection.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, through the chair. Second question was, did we weigh in, or did this, again, through the chair, did the state of Alaska weigh in on the offshore, you know, designation where it kind of basically took all of our, a lot of our offshore potential away? Did we send somebody a letter and kind of note our objections?
Representative Birch, through the chair, yes. We spent a tremendous amount of time in the last year on OCS issues, and we actually went through the process of formally nominating under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act both the Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas for development. In other words, we asserted the state's interest in both the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, and we went so far as to, you know, tell them that we got right into the detailed analysis and legally nominated those areas for development. And it was the decision or decisions in that area were very disappointing.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
Please continue.
Turning over, you know, I wanted to finish up on the North Slope. In addition to the conventional plays of oil and gas, there's the unconventional plays, and I'm just going to leave it at the fact that there's a lot more, and there are companies that are interested. When you hear about Great Bear, Cumulative Energy, and those types of companies, they're looking for unconventional plays in to the south of Prudhoe Bay. Cook Inlet has significant resources, 19 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, 600 million barrels of oil, and 46 million barrels of natural gas liquids. And, you know, and it came up earlier in when the introductions were going on, too. We now are seeing companies in the Middle Earth and in the interior looking for both oil and gas. And Doyon is very active in that area. Otna is out looking. And that's very exciting for the state of Alaska, too. Slide 5 is that the state of Alaska, is an unbelievable mineral basin. The state of Alaska ranks in the top 10 in the world for important minerals, including 70% of the world's coal, and which is second most in the world in any particular jurisdiction. 4% of the world's copper occurs in Alaska, which is the eighth most in the world. 4% of the world's lead, and the list goes on. And we think that mining has unbelievable untapped potential, and we're only scratching the surface. We have a number of active producing mines now. There's several in development, and we spend quite a bit of time working to make sure that they have a path forward, and we think we have a good relationship and an agreement that they'll operate safely, and we spend a lot of time on that, and that would be in Mr. Fogel's side of the organization. Alaska ranked second for mineral potential in the 2015 Fraser Institute Study of Mining Companies with more than 7,400 document prospects. Alaska has the potential to lead the nation in mineral production. So the next slide, Madam Chair, is really just the organizational chart on a very, very high level. It includes three members of the Commissioner's Office, myself. I'll just do it. To my left here is obviously Mr. Wiggin, the Deputy Commissioner, presides over the oil and gas portion of the Department of Natural Resources. That includes the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Again, Steve Masterman, the Director, is on the phone. The Division of Oil and Gas, and also the Mental Health Trust Land Office, and Mr. Morrison is here. Mr. Fogel presides over and manages the Division of Agriculture, the Division of Mining, Land and Water. Mr. Goodrum's on the phone in Anchorage, the Office of Project Management and Permitting, Division of Forestry, Division of Parks, and the Division of Sports Services.
Can I intervene here?
Secretary?
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Commissioner, we'll be dealing with this at more length, but if nothing else, hopefully what comes out of this is something that I'm going to assume that Representative Guttenberg, when we look at the budget, will be curious about. I know that the Office of Project Management and Permitting, which you call OPMP, has evolved even more recently, just in the last couple of years, to sort of be fully funded by developers and explorers and producers. And I'm going to be interested in how much of that is done so that we can save general fund dollars in the other sections. And I don't want to waylay us or digress, but I think that's going to be something that we're going to want to look at. Just to sort of plant that seed a little bit.
Sounds good, Mr. Co-Chair. So I think we're now at the part of the presentation where we'd like to get in and go through the various divisions. And for the directors and the managers who are in the room, we'll ask them to step up to the table. We'll introduce them. And they can get into a brief overview of what they do within their divisions, talk about what they've been working on in 2016, field any questions. Certainly, we are happy to answer questions as well. So why don't we start with Mr. Keyes coming up, and we'll give Mr. Keyes a brief introduction, and then he can talk about the Division of Agriculture.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Tarr, Co-Chair Josephson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ed Fogels, Deputy Commissioner of Department. It's my pleasure to introduce Arthur Keyes. He's been serving as our Director of Agriculture for about a year now, right? Pretty close. 11 months. He's a successful farmer in the Palmer area, and not only that, but he spearheaded a very successful farmers market, the South Anchorage Farmers Market, which I spend a lot of Saturday mornings there, and I love local food, and Alaska needs more local food, and we need to improve our food security, and I think Arthur's been a real champion for that. So I guess with that, I will turn the microphone over to Director Keyes, and he can run through his slides.
Thank you, Ed. Ma'am, Co-Chair.
Yes, nice to see you. Welcome, and I believe your own representative on the committee today.
Absolutely.
So please give us your presentation if you would put yourself on the record.
For the record, I am Arthur Keyes, the Director of the Division of Agriculture. So my presentation today is about the Division of Agriculture. We provide land sales, loans, inspections, we manage the Alaska Grown Program, and then we also oversee other essential programs vital to the agriculture industry. The Division of Agriculture, one of the sections of the Division of Agriculture is the Plant Materials Center, and it is the sole source of native seed for the state of Alaska for our unique growing conditions. And if we can go to the next slide, I'll touch a little bit more on that. The PMC, we have our top three, our first three bullets are going to be about the PMC. And the PMC treated 657 surface acres of Lodia-infested waterways in Anchorage in the Mat-Su. For those that don't know what a Lodia is, it's an aquatic invasive plant that causes problems for floatplanes, native fish species, and just outcompetes Alaska's your natural habitat. The PMC produced a record 1,837 pounds of certified seed potatoes this past year. These potatoes were sold to producers in South Central Alaska, the interior, Kodiak, and in Southeast. This 1,837 pounds of seed potatoes translates to roughly $3 million in retail sales of potatoes once those are grown out for the table stock. The Plant Material Center processed more than 177,000 pounds of grass seed. This is for revegetation and reclamation projects. This is going to be for one of the biggest customers. Is going to be DOT, your mine sites, and we do a lot of work with Red Dog. Anybody that has a reclamation project, roadways, forestry, stream bank stabilization. So it impacts all forms of wildlife, whether it's salmon regular animals are used to dealing with. The Division of Agriculture, our ag promotion, we educated some clarity here. The next bullet, we educated 14 communities and 175 producers about farm food safety practices. And so for some clarity on that, that actually is an activity that's happened over the past 3 years. But on-farm food safety is probably one of the biggest issues and challenges that I see facing America's farmers as well as Alaska's farmers. So that's a pretty important topic to me in this role. We conducted 350 field inspections, and the diversity of these inspections is pretty broad. From the timber industry to seed potatoes fields to seed grass, certified seed grass, cool audits, which is country of origin labeling, and that would that's going to impact your grocery stores and any retail outlet. Country of origin labeling is a pretty big deal. It's a federal program. Farmers markets, and also inspecting the retail and then doing farm visits. This past year, we are facilitating the transition of McKinley Meat and Sausage to the private sector, and I'd like to give you some background on that. For those members that aren't familiar with it, McKinley Meat and Sausage is located in Palmer, Alaska. It's an asset of the ARLF, which is the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund. It is the only USDA-approved slaughter facility in South Central Alaska. Farmers statewide use this facility from Homer, Kenai Peninsula. I imagine that there have been farmers from Kodiak that have brought animals over and used it, from the Delta Junction, Fairbanks area, Nanana. They all come down and use this facility. It is a vital piece of infrastructure to the agriculture industry in Alaska, and certainly the protein production. There are millions of dollars in agriculture loans that are dependent on this facility to provide that USDA stamp, so these products can be sold at the retail markets, farmers markets, anywhere that's going to get into the final cut of meat. It's going to need that USDA stamp. I cannot stress enough the importance of this facility and what it means for agriculture, what it means for food security in Alaska. And I can touch on food security at a later date, but when you realize, start discussing how tenuous our food security situation is here, it really is mind-boggling. And this facility is a huge link in that chain. It's noteworthy to say that the ARLF took possession of this facility in 1986. And over the course of the years, it has traditionally lost money. I think there was 1 year, Ed, where it showed a profit, but it tends to come across as a loss. What can't be forgotten, though, in this mix is that it has been a holdover from Alaska Correctional Industries as a prisoner training business. And it's very hybridized, and I think very unique. I doubt there's any other facility in the state that's as unique as this one in that regard. The losses incurred are typically between $100,000 to $150,000 a year. These losses are, because it's an asset of the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund, these losses are paid directly out of the interest payments that farmers are going to be making to ARLF. So no losses from this facility are coming out of UGF. The state has been wanting to divest itself of this facility for many years. When ACI, the history on that, when that started to wind down, I think the state looked at selling this facility, and they did an RFP, I believe, in 2002. Does that seem right to you, Ed? Mm-hmm. And then also in 2006. And both times that they did it, there were no applicants. And I think at one point in time it was even five. They offered it up for $5.
Yeah,
it was
$1.
$1.
Yes.
So just to give you some of the history on this facility and the importance of it, in the last legislative session, it was indicated that we needed to sell this facility. So one of the first things as director, I got to dive right into this process, and it's probably been the most consuming topic of my tenure so far as director of ag. We released an RFP in July of 2016, and essentially once the Board of Agriculture met and took a look at the RFP applicants that came in, they determined that they weren't valid. They didn't have a valid applicant for a variety of reasons that we don't need to get into. So the Board of Ag went back to the RFP process, changed the terms a little bit, responding to some of the feedback that we received from the agriculture community from the previous RFP, and put the RFP back out again. And in the course of that, we did get a qualified applicant for the facility. That process, I think in December 9th of this year, of 2016, the Board of Ag met and overviewed the RFP and accepted it. We are currently in the process. We have just put it out for public comment as of Sunday, and next week we will be in the position to actually sign the sales agreement with this RFP applicant. And so I'm very hopeful, and I believe we have a solution. I believe that the future is very positive, and I'll be signing that next week if everything comes together. Once that happens, we'll be entering a 90-day basically due diligence process where the person has the opportunity to go back and forth and maybe do a little more deeper inspection of the facility. But right now everything looks very well.
Yes, Representative Rauscher.
Through the speaker, Mr. Keyes, the response that you said you had gotten, was that what was the response from the public comment? Was it favorable, mostly, largely favorable, 50-50? I just was wondering.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, mm-hmm. The feedback we got on the RFP, the one in July, I think that's what you're referencing,
mm-hmm.
There were some concerns. I think the Board of Agriculture and Conservation has looked at this as an asset, a real estate asset that they want to do right by. Okay. And in that process, the RFP that was written that we ended up not going with, it was like a negotiation process where it was only one-sided. And so once the input came back in, they were to really incorporate just a few ideas. It wasn't major problems, just a few little stumbling blocks that they tuned right up.
Madam Chair, I have a lot of agricultural land in my in my district, and it's very big. There's a lot of diverse opinions out there. That's the only reason for my questioning. Mm-hmm. No opinion one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know that for. I just wanted to qualify my question. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good question. Thank you, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. May I ask, are there any protections in place for the pricing? Because if it's been a loss, if they've been losing money for the past, the only way I could see, well, the primary way I could see to make it profitable and interesting to a private business would be to pretty dramatically increase the prices for the meat producers. Is there? Would you please speak to that concern?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish. So certainly from the business standpoint, you could say we could raise the prices, and you know, if you're running 1,000 animals through a year and we need to hit X amount of dollars, we could raise the price until we hit that threshold. Where I see agriculture today, and certainly the livestock industry, I think we're seeing some massive growth. Since I have been director of ag, we've seen the numbers increase. We have run a record amount of animals through McKinley Meat and Sausage this year. So one way is to raise the price. The other way is to increase volume. From my standpoint, and my background as a business owner and manager, volume solves a lot of problems. And I see that is exactly where I see this plant going. I see it going to private ownership. I see volume going up. And, I don't think it's fair for me to comment on what someone's business practices are going to be. However, you know, competition really solves a lot of problems, too. If the price goes too high, then you know, one of the natural market forces would be maybe some competition comes in. You know, I don't know if that'll happen. But regardless, I think a good business owner is going to treat it like a good business. And I think I would expect it to be competitive and remain competitive for the producers.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative?
No. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and I had the pleasure of touring the plant a couple of summers ago. We've got great pictures somewhere of us in the lab coats and the hair nets and all that stuff. And it was in full production. You know, we saw a pig wrapped in, you know, saran wrap, for lack of a better word, and the prisoners working on various aspects of processing meat, learned a lot about what goes into it. I also understand there's only two other such plants in the state that are USDA capable, but the distance from South Central Alaska is such that if this plant was to shut down, it would pretty much destroy protein production in South Central because of the distances and the conflicts with hunting season at the other two plants. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond. Certainly, I'm glad to talk about that. The other two plants that you reference, again, I don't want to speak to their business plans. However, I have met with one of them through the facility, and it's my understanding that you really hit it right on the head when you said that the wild game processing, mm-hmm. you know, that seems to me to be a huge component mm-hmm. of their business plan and their model. So what was indicated to me is that it's traditionally they shut down for 2 months during game season, mm-hmm. and they shut down from processing livestock, because they're two things that can't cross on the same kill floor. You can't have your wild game production mm-hmm. happening, processing, and then at the same time, you know, later that day, do some livestock. That's not how the USDA plan works. So that 2 month shutdown would be devastating for the producers. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most important thing. The distance to to these plants from traveling from home or say to Delta Junction would be an incredible burden that would affect anybody's business plan drastically and negatively. So that's definitely a consideration. However, if they shut down for 2 months, I think that's really the final nail in the coffin mm-hmm. in saying that they could pick up the output that McKinley Meat, if McKinley Meat were to shut down and that were to go. The other thing is, I mentioned earlier about the increases in production. Without going into specifics, because I do not have the numbers in front of me, the numbers that we've run through McKinley Meats, I believe, have set a record. for the past, well, I've been there for 11 months, and I believe the last 11 months you're going to see a record number of animals go through there. Now, if that were to close down, and there's two USDA plants, that are one in Fairbanks and one in Delta Junction, certainly that's not conducive to growing the livestock industry. Mm-hmm. If we're pushing record numbers, if McKinley's were to shut down or close, and then start trying to push all those animals up there, it's not. I don't view it as feasible. Mm-hmm. McKinley needs it, is vital.
And follow up.
Yes.
Do you know what percentage of the meat sold commercially in Alaska is run through that particular plant?
I do not know that. If you would like, that's something I can find out.
Yeah, there's no rush. No, I do know that we produce maybe 5% of the food that is actually eaten in Alaska, and I imagine the meat production is going to be along the same lines, but it would be really valuable to have that in terms of food security and planning purposes. Thank you.
Representative
Rasko. Madam Chair, through the Chair, Director Keyes. I don't really want to dwell on it any more longer than we have to, but I do want to know, was 4-H taken into consideration, how much they relied on McKinley News? I was just wondering whether or not they were taken into consideration and how that might have been addressed.
Through the Chair, Representative Rasher. I think that's a great question. I think the 4-H kids, I mean, that's the future. I mean, without young farmers coming on board, what are we going to eat? Right. So the 4-H, I mean, that's the first, step for developing that love of this industry. So in all of my meetings with the potential, what I anticipate to be the new owner of McKinley Meat and Sausage, he has indicated to me that he is absolutely 100% behind 4-H. And, I think he's gonna hug him.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I could just add one thing, too, just to sort of, before we leave this topic. 2 years ago, there was a legislative audit on the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund, and one of its main points is that the fund should not be holding and managing assets, and essentially said we should divest ourselves of these assets, which we are doing, and this is sort of one of the last ones for the direction of the audit.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for bringing that up. And for members online, you can go to the Legislative Budget and Audit website and search for that. And we can, through our office, send that link out for everyone to review and just have a little more background information. And if I could, Director Keyes, I know in the RFP there were some stipulations about access, not pricing, as I understand, but access to make sure that farmers who currently have access to the facility would continue to have access to the facility throughout the transition to new ownership. And I wondered if I have that right, or if you could just speak to that briefly.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair, certainly. The original RFP was put out in July. That seemed to be one of the biggest hang-ups, because it basically dictated to whoever bought the plant that you would do this for this, addressing maybe 4-H as well, and saying you must do these things. And what was brought forth very clearly from interested parties is it restricting, tying someone's hand and asking them to take over this business and run it successfully? Because that's really what we want. We want it to run in the black and make some money so that we don't have to worry about it closing. Tying someone's hand before they even have a chance to get in there and see and look at the numbers and look at the considerations of the number of animals they're going through was not fair. It wasn't right. And that was one of the biggest things that they addressed. So it maybe left it a little bit ambiguous by reducing those restrictions. However, if you look at the numbers, the people that are interested in buying this, we're talking investment by the time they're done fixing, and adjusting and making things up, we're talking $500,000, maybe more, of an investment. And from the business standpoint, their interest is keeping that business running, and that means servicing every single person that walks up to their door. And that's their goal, is to service and provide a service for everybody that wants it. And so with that restriction changed, reduced, we actually, like I said, I think we're in a successful situation. It's very exciting.
Thank you. Any other questions on the Mount McKinley before we go on? Okay. Thank you. Director Keyes, please continue.
Thank you. The ARLF, the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund, started in 1953 before statehood. I think it's very notable. It managed, last year it managed 66 loans for agriculture equipment, property, and activities with principal loan balance of $7.69 million, with six new loans in 2016. We leveraged, the Division of Ag, we leveraged more than $1.3 million in federal grant funding for state and industry-driven projects. The Elodia invasive project was, I know that was one of these federal grants that we utilized to fight that invasive. We inspected a very exciting project. We inspected more than 116 million board feet of timber. This enabled exports that generated $93 million in timber industry revenue. And this is a Division of Agriculture program that was developed at the Division of Agriculture to facilitate timber from Southeast that maybe didn't have quite as much value as an older growth product would have. This program was facilitated so that we would do these inspections and make it accessible to the Asian market. And very exciting project. Would love to answer any questions if you had them on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what
Representative Joseph said.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Keyes, a couple questions on that. The first would be what revenue the state derives from that $93 million, if you know. And it may be that Mr. Mache is the better person to ask, but actually that's apropos in that I'm curious why your division does that inspection and the Division of Forestry, I'm sure it does some other inspection, but do you know that Division of Labor and how that happens?
Certainly. Through the chair and Representative Justison. So the Division of Agriculture inspections historically are that's what we do. We have the SPRO, which is a state plant regulatory officer. That's an agriculture duty. That's what we have. So these timber inspections, they need to happen under the SPRO. Again, SPRO, state plant regulatory officer. And that, again, is a Division of Agriculture position. I mean, and that person's going to oversee certified seed potatoes, anything that needs inspected. That's the person, and that's recognized at the federal level. And so that's why timber. And historically, if you were to look at an agriculture in other states, in more than one instance, you're going to find that forestry and agriculture, they're basically one and the same in some states. So it's not really as odd as it might at first seem.
Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, Co-Chair Josephson, just to add to that too, I mean, Director Mache could probably add a little more detail to the revenue source, but most of the state timber in Southeast that we sell is designed to go to the local mills. So this program is really round log exports to Asia. And most of the bulk of that comes off of private lands, I think Native Corporation lands.
Okay. Okay.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. So, my question was, somewhere you said that you grade the timber or you inspect the timber for export. Is that, did you just give a little overview of that just for my incomplete understanding?
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So I'll be very brief on this because I would hate to tell you something that's not accurate and I can provide more information later. The inspection that we provide happens in Asia. We send an inspector there and they fumigate the logs and we are certifying that the fumigation happened. Certifying that so that these logs can continue into the port where they're going to be processed. Is that, Ed, would you surprise them?
Yes, Representative Johnson, through the chair. The Asian countries won't accept logs from the U.S. unless they've been properly fumigated to make sure that there aren't any invasive bugs or critters in there, right? So per international trade protocols, those a certified phytosanitary inspector has to certify that that was done properly, and that's why the Division of Ag staff are key to doing that, because they're certified at doing this kind of work. It's important to note that Alaska is the only state that can actually certify this is done over in Asia. Every other, we have an exception. The international trade protocols require that this fumigation be done in the U.S. before it leaves U.S. soil. And because we don't have fumigation facilities in Alaska, we had a very rare exception from the USDA to be able to go over there and do those fumigations.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you, Director Keyes, if there's one topic on the seed potato, and we've kind of transitioned in this on the certification, just if you could just explain how that's so critical to that. Those inspections are necessary before those potatoes can be distributed for growing in the state, that's a requirement. So that's not really a service that the state of Alaska could consider doing away with.
Certainly, Madam Co-Chair. Yes, the Alaska is one of the cleanest environments in the world. We all know this. We live here. I mean, and our agriculture is no exception. You know, we do not suffer the ills that they have in the lower 48. As it was explained to me by one farmer, he said it's the equivalent of Alaska being in quarantine almost. You know, we have so much more distance between the next producer that we just have this pristine environment. So certified seed potatoes, that ensures that our environment's going to stay clean. We don't need to have the diseases that they have in some of these lower 48 locales. We can keep Alaska clean. That seed inspection, that's just a very minor. It's not a huge expense, but it's producing upwards of $3 million in economic activity, food security, and certainly who wants to live in a place where there's no food? So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you very much. Any other questions for our division director, Representative Tallarico?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask about the Elodia. I know that you've got something here in Anchorage and Matt, too, and I know that we're developing quite a nasty problem in the North Star Borough, and particularly up in Fairbanks. Any focus on that, you think, in the future, and some assistance, any projects planned for the Fairbanks area?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Tallarico. Yes, absolutely. We are actually just, I believe, in the permitting process for a project up in the North Star Borough. And I think in February that will be finalized. And then this summer we can actually move forward with treating the infestation. I could get you more information exactly where and all the details. But we are working, and we have worked in from the Kenai Peninsula, Anchorage, Mat-Su, and now Fairbanks.
Great. And Director Keyes, if you would send those to our office, we can distribute those if those would be items of interest for the full committee. Thank you.
All right.
And follow up.
Just follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. On the meat plant, if you wouldn't mind letting the co-chairs know, if that's successful and you get that signed, I think that would be great. So if I understand it correctly, we're actually moving from the state being a butcher shop to actually getting that into private industry.
Absolutely.
So we're maturing a little bit, and I think that's great news. Right. So thank you very much for your work on that, though. I know that wasn't easy, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well said. Thank you for joining us today. Great presentation.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, next in our presentation is the Division of Forestry, and as the Commissioner mentioned on the phone, we have Director Chris Mesh from Fairbanks. Chris has been our director for probably about 10 years now, and he's been a great asset to DNR, and he's responsible not only for putting out all our wildfires, but managing our state timberlands for the benefit of Alaskans and a lot of the businesses that depend on them. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Director Mesh.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Mesh, Director of the Division of Forestry, and we should be on slide 9 if you haven't advanced it.
We are with you.
That's where we're at. So, okay, great. So what I want to do today is give you a quick overview of the Division of Forestry, and then I'll hit a few highlights of what we've accomplished this past year. The Division's mission is to serve Alaskans through sustainable forest management and wildland fire protection. You can see our FY17 operating budget was about $47 million, of which about $24.2 million of that is UGF, and there are 239 positions in the division, which makes the division one of the larger divisions in DNR, I think both in number and also budget. And, of course, a large percentage of that budget is the fire part of the budget, which I'll touch on briefly in a few minutes. The division is the lead state agency for wildland fire management on 150 million acres, which is with the primary goal of protecting life and property. And we are the primary manager for 47 million acres of forest lands that are considered commercial forest lands of the state's entitlement acres, which was mentioned earlier, about 105 million. We also have three state forests that are just around 2 million acres in size that we manage as part of that effort. Moving on to the fires for the 2016 fire season, you can see we had 354 separate fires in state protection areas that burned just a little over 104,000 acres of land, which is one of our lowest years in recent memory. And I'd like to contrast that a bit, if I may, with last year, calendar year 2016, which was our second worst year in terms of acres burned. We burned 5.1 million acres last year, and there was a record of 766 individual fires. So the contrast between these 2 years is about as far apart as you can get, but it helps demonstrate the dynamic fire seasons we have here in Alaska. We can have a year like we had last year where it was a very difficult year for us. We had many states from around the country and Canada helped respond to that effort. And likewise, this year we responded to efforts in the lower 48, in the southern states and the western states. So it's a very dynamic program, and the amount of acres burned and budget expended each year correspond to that. If you're interested in the budget number, the fire season for this past season in UGF is about $26.2 million was spent on fire suppression activities. And by contrast, last year, calendar year 15, the budget expenditure was $103.4 million in UGF. So quite an extreme, not only in acres, but also in the amount of funding used to suppress those fires. Next, I'd like to talk a little bit about the timber forest management program. From this past year, we sold 8.2 million board feet of logs in 34 different timber sales around Alaska. Those are in communities all up through the Rail Belt area and down into southeast Alaska. And those went to 27 different Alaska-based companies. I would like to make the point that this is actually one of our lowest years on record for the amount of timber sold. And our average is about 23.2 million feet of volume sold each year and about 62 sales. So the volume sold off by about two-thirds and the number of sales off about half. The reasons for that are many, but probably the biggest two are the budget reductions the division has sustained over the last 3 years in the forest management side of the division. It's about a 42% reduction over those three fiscal years, and also environmental NGO challenges in our Southeast Timber Program. Prior to last year, the state had never been challenged by any of the environmental NGOs in Southeast Alaska. And after the state signed on to the Tongass transition effort, some of the more extreme groups have challenged every timber sale the state has put up in Southeast. So we've been working our way through those challenges. Have cleared many of those now, so we'll start seeing more volume offered in Southeast Alaska. Go on to the next slide, if you would, for me, please, Deputy Commissioner. Mm-hmm. This slide 10. This slide outlines some of the successes and main projects for the division last year, and probably the biggest is again the wildland fire side of the division. We had two large project fires last year, one outside the community of Tetlin and the other just outside the community of Anchorage. The fire names were the Tetlin River Fire and the McHugh Fire just outside of Anchorage. Both those incidents were managed successfully. We also had success this year of having we do a lot of emergency firefighter hire to help us suppress these fires. I'm very pleased to say that we had a very high percentage of Alaska hire this year. It was about 93% of the hires we used were Alaska residents. That generates about $5.5 million in payroll to those EFF firefighters, and many of those firefighters come from our rural communities in all around Alaska. So that was a very successful metric for us. In contrast, the last year, only about 50% of the firefighters we used on the fires were from within Alaska. But that goes just to the amount of fire that we had on the landscape and the size of the response that we had to make. Very, very different scale last year. In addition to that, the lower 48 fire assignments that I mentioned earlier, those are Alaska crews, both agency crews and our EFF crews. They generated about $5.6 million in wages for Alaskans. And we had Alaskans still fighting fire in the southern states in November and into December this year. We had about 170 people out at the peak of that response. And so we actually had to call people back from seasonal layoff to help respond to that incident, those incidents in the southern states. We also received four competitive grants for hazard fuel reduction projects around different communities in Alaska. And these projects reduce hazardous fuel that would cause higher risk to facilities around communities and construct fuel breaks to help us prevent fire from reaching communities should there be wildland fire near them. The three communities that we have these grants around are the Caswell Lakes area, the McGrath area, and the Delta Junction area. And these are competitive grants the division competes for nationally, and the amount we received this year is right around $800,000 in funding. And I'm very pleased that the staff remains competitive in bringing that kind of money to Alaska. Unfortunately, we don't have any state general fund money that we use for hazard fuel mitigation work. There's never been any appropriated. So the only source we have for this type of work is through federal programs. And so the staff goes out of their way to try and secure this money. And it's been very successful in helping us protect communities. A great example is the Funny River Fire from last season, and the fuel break in that community literally saved the Funny River part of that town. That's where we actually lit a burnout from, and were successful in preventing the fire from crossing that fuel break. Moving on, back on the question.
Let me just jump in here for a moment. Representative Parrish had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Director Mish. First of all, I'd like to compliment you on 94% Alaska hired in 2016. That's wonderful. I do have a couple of questions, particularly relating to the 42% reduction in staff over 3 years. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative, yes. From FY15 to FY17, we, on the forest management side of the division, saw about a 39% reduction in TCN numbers and a 42% reduction in budget of general fund.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Through the Chair. You also mentioned a two-thirds reduction in timber sales. Can you tell us how much that is in lost revenues to the state and in economic activity in Alaska?
Through the Chair, Representative, yes. We annually generate roughly about $980,000 in revenue from our timber sale program. And as Deputy Fogles, Commissioner Fogles mentioned earlier, most of that revenue comes from our southern southeast timber program. Most of the timber sales we sell there, we target for domestic processing. And by doing that, we don't generate as high a revenue for those logs as we could. If we sold the logs on the export market that was discussed earlier, they're more valuable, but the state for many administrations has made the decision that jobs are more important than pure revenue in this case. And so I just want you to understand the context of the discussion about the revenue that can be generated from timber sales. So last year was our lowest year in Southeast Alaska for volume sold. And it'll be our revenue will suffer accordingly. I don't know what the exact number is. I can get that for you, but it'll be at least half of what our long-term average is.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair. Through the chair, I'm just remembering back. I'm not sure if it was last year or the year before. I've been thinking it was last year where, well, we're pleased to have a division or an office for forestry and regarding the wildland fires management in Palmer. And as I recall, the fire season was so extreme that we got into emergency budget. We went through the budget for fire, and there was an appropriation to continue the firefighting. Can you refresh my memory on where did those funds come from, and how did that impact like a future budget or what you may be looking at or asking for firefighting here in the future?
Yes, through the chair, Representative. That's not a quick answer. It might be best to take that up in detail when we do discuss budget, but I can give you a quick overview of that. The fire budget's a fairly complicated one because the fire season is split by two fiscal years, which really makes it difficult to talk about in fiscal year sense, but that's how it happens. The fiscal year, of course, ends in June 30th, and fire season is only about halfway done at that point. So the way we supplement our appropriated dollars that we get in what's called the activity code, which is when we spend money to fight fire, we spend out of that code. The rest of our budget is in a preparedness code, which is basically be ready to fight fire. We don't use those funds to actually suppress the fire. So the activity account is where funds come from to actually fight and suppress fires. And there's actually two aspects of the activity account, because we also suppress fires on federal lands. But we're reimbursed by the federal government for that effort. And I'd be happy to meet with you individually or talk to the whole committee about the process of how that all unfolds during a fire season. But it's a rather complicated dance that we do to balance the books at the end of a fire season. It takes actually 2 years to balance those books with our federal partners and other states that we help and vice versa. And all the funds that are for state-protected lands are general fund money. All the funds for federal lands are federal money. The state also protects, of course, state, private, and municipal lands as part of our statutory authorities for the fire program. Hope that answered your question, but I can give you more detail if you'd like.
Thank you very much.
Okay, looks like we're good here. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, I'll try and wrap up here because I think we're running on close to my time limit. So just two other key programs I wanted to point out this last year that are very important. Work on the Tongass National Forest, on the transition from old growth to young growth, which is a U.S. Forest Service effort with their new forest management plan. The state is a major partner in trying to assist the Forest Service with that. We just recently signed what's referred to as a Good Neighbor Authority Agreement. It's called GNA. And it was authority authorized in the 2012 Farm Bill that allows states around the country to assume management responsibility under state authorities for timber sales on federal lands. The federal government still completes the NEPA part of that effort, and then the state completes the remaining steps. We're in the process of negotiating what's called a supplemental project agreement to undertake a large timber sale on Kosciuszko Island. It's a 28 million foot sale. And we're just in the process of starting the negotiation under that master agreement for this this project agreement. So that's a pretty big deal for us and a really a big step for the Forest Service and the state to be working hand-in-hand like that. The other program I wanted to mention was a forest inventory project up in Interior Alaska. Again, this is federally funded. No general fund money goes to this, but it's we were the last place in the country to have the FIA program implemented in Interior Alaska. And what this program does is do long-term measurements of forest productivity, allows us to create sustained yield calculations to help support biomass projects, particularly in rural communities around Alaska. And this project we are contracting to do with the Forest Service, and it'll bring in about $1.1 to $2 million annually to the division, and actually is a bright spot in our budget considering the reductions we've taken on the general fund side. So perhaps I'll just pause now and see if there's any other questions. And
yep, there are. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nash, Andy Josephson here, and I have a question about your page 10
conducting 54 inspections on private timber sales. And I don't mean to ask this in a sense of I'm looking for cost-cutting measures, but you've identified some things there about water quality and fish habitat. And I know that DEC and Fish and Game are involved. Can you explain, are those reimbursable service agreements? How are those inspections integrated with your fellow departments?
Mr. Co-Chair, I can elaborate on that. Those inspections occur under the auspices of the State Forest Resources and Practices Act. It's called FRPA for short. DNR is the lead agency for that effort, but we work with our two sister agencies, ADF&G and DEC. And as it's stated there in the slide, the Act is designed to protect fish habitat and water quality. And the Act has a series of statutes and regulations and best management practices that have to be undertaken by private landowners. And so those 54 inspections were on private land, primarily Alaska Native corporations in Kodiak and Southeast Alaska are the two main areas where that activity has occurred. And then 82 inspections on state lands because the state also has to comply with the Act. To answer your question about the way the Act works is we provide due deference to our sister agencies on the areas they are experts in, which is, of course, fisheries and water quality. But the Act is designed for each agency to support their own costs in this effort. And, again, that's a budget question that probably we could go into more detail on. I'm not sure we have time at the moment, but right now each of the three departments support their own efforts. Okay. In that, so no money exchanges hands between the three agencies.
Thank you, Ms.
To complete that.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members before we move on? Commissioner Mack.
Madam Chair, I'd like to add one point here that is not raised and we can get into more detail, is that there have been a number of concerns raised in the most recent plan by the Forest Service to manage the Tongass. And we formally objected. Both myself at a limited level, but Deputy Commissioner Vogels, Director Mache, Department of Law participated in process of lodging those complaints. We commented extensively, participated in, you know, the group which developed the Tongass plan, and frankly, we continue to have concerns and work through that process. At the same time, I think what Chris is, Director Mache is pointing out, that we continue to take advantage of some of the work being done on the young growth inventory and also the Good Neighbor Authority. So, you know, it's our hope that we get a better result in the larger Tongass Management Plan while we continue to work where we can with the federal government. In addition, there's a significant effort back in Washington, D.C. by our delegation to identify additional federal funds that come through what is effectively their funds identified for fire suppression. In down years, they have a budget number, there's excess money, and we're hoping to redirect some of those funds back into the planning process so that we can complete the inventory quickly and efficiently and also do the NEPA processes necessary to conduct federal federal timber sales in Southeast Alaska in particular. It's not here, it's a, as you know, a complex issue, but there's a lot of work that goes into it.
Representative Birch.
Through the chair, where are we at with our roadless rule?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I think Mr. Mache is the right person to ask. That is an issue within the Tongass plan. Chris?
Yes, again, for the record, this is Chris Mache, Director of Division of Forestry, through the chair, Representative Birch. The roadless rule is we still have one piece of litigation that is pending between the state of Alaska and the U.S. Forest Service, and that's actually in the District Court of Columbia in D.C. And it's a challenge to the overall roadless rule. The case was argued over a year ago now, so as the attorneys tell me, the case is ripe for a decision. We are expecting a decision on that case almost any day. That's the last case in the country that is pending before the court on the 2001 roadless rule. And so depending on the outcome of that case, it could have some major ramifications for not only just Alaska, but other states as well.
follow up?
I just wanted to say thank you for that update. It's good to hear your voice, Director Mache. And I also want to thank you for the good work you did in South Anchorage on the McHugh Creek fire last summer. It was a significant concern in a large area of my neighborhood. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the comment.
Don't go away just yet, Director. Another question from Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Co-Chair, through the Chair, of the $60 million acres to which we're entitled to be transferred over from federal to state, and the $40 million which have been tentatively approved, how much of those are in areas which are likely to increased fires in the coming years, and how many are forestry lands in Southeast, for instance?
Yes, through the co-chair to Representative Parrish. That's a good question, and let me just put it simply. Most of Alaska can burn, whether it's got trees or not. Even the tundra has the ability to burn under the right conditions. As far as a breakdown of the actual acres in our state entitlement of the 105 million we're due, we provide protection to all those lands right now as the primary responding agency. There's two main suppression agencies in the state of Alaska: the Alaska Fire Service, which is part of BLM, a federal agency, and then Division of Forestry. And we split the state in half and respond to fires in what we call our service area. And so that means I protect federal land in my service area as well as private land, and vice versa. And that's more efficient and more cost-effective to do it that way than each agency trying to run to where the land ownership is and fight the fire that they're responsible on that land base. So it's a little hard to answer your question the way it was worded, but I'd be happy to give you more detail about the fire management plan that's in place for the whole state and how we conduct that business.
Thank you. I'll be in touch.
And Director Mache, again, if you want to send that through the co-chair's offices, then we can distribute that information to all members of the committee. Deputy Commissioner Fogel.
Yes, Representative Parrish, through the chair, I'd just add that there are very, very little state land or state selections in Southeast Alaska. It's mostly federal Tongass National Forest. If you look at the map behind you, or even the map that's on the wall behind the screen, you can see state selections marked on that map in the different shades of brown. The legend on the upper right will show you, and you'll see that they're scattered, the 5 million acres that we have selected, scattered throughout kind of the northern, you know, central part of Alaska for the most part.
And follow up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Deputy Director Fogel. I was wondering about the pending transfers, the 60 million acres, if I recall correctly, to which we're still entitled. Is this us with all of our wishes already made?
Representative Parrish, to the chair. Again, this is Deputy Commissioner Fogles. Let me just explain that 60 million, 40 million split. In sum, we've received 100 million acres of land from the federal government of our 105 million acre entitlement. Of that 100 million acres, 60 million have been patented. 40 million are still what we call tentatively approved. They're essentially state lands for all practical purposes. We have legal management authority over them. They are state lands. So for all practical purposes, we now have 100 million acres of state land, and we're owed five.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions before we let Director Mache off the hook? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, I just wanted to know if Chris, if you have any concerns over the recently adopted Eastern Interior Plan and I believe the Central Yukon Plan that the Bureau of Land Management is about to put out for have some public meetings and public comments. It seems like to me there's quite an overlay on the Tanana Valley State Forest, which of course is a really incredibly large forest. Any particular concerns that you see in either of those plans, possibly with the areas of critical environmental concern, I believe, is how they designate some of those. And I think we've got some BLM overlays into our state forest. They're going to create a management issue for you in the future?
Through the co-chair, Representative Tallarico, We've not done an extensive analysis of that particular issue that you raised for the state forest, but I don't anticipate any difficulties managing the state forest because of those two federal plans that you mentioned. Director Goodrum might have some additional insights to that, so you might also query him on that question. I think maybe general state land might be more effective than state forest land. But at any rate, at this stage of the game, I don't anticipate any difficulties. Won't inhibit how we manage the land or what we've been doing to date anyways.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Mack.
Representative Tallarico, through the chair, both of the issues that you mentioned, one is the Eastern Interior Plan, which was made public and approved by the BLM in 2016, and the Central Yukon Plan, which has been on the table for a number of years and includes both the pipeline corridor and the entire North Slope, including all of the about 98% of the oil producing areas on the North Slope are of very, very significant concern to the state. We are right now at the stage with respect to the Eastern Interior Plan where we are, we have objected and we have run the administrative course. Our objections, we got a, I would be happy to inundate you with some paperwork. We got a sweet letter from the director of BLM indicating that they had received our objections with respect to the Eastern Interior Plan. A lot of the focus there is on the 40-mile district. There's a number of other issues, both process and substantive, that we've identified. We met recently with Doyon Corporation, which has some very, very significant interest in that region, and we will be evaluating and making a decision on our strategy going forward. Included in that conversation is what our litigation strategy might be, but there's been no decision made. The Central Yukon Plan, Representative, is immensely concerning to us because for all the committee's edification, it is a BLM plan which plans over the North Slope of Alaska. So, really, it's of significant concern to us. And we can take it up in far greater detail at some point.
Thank you, Commissioner. And again, those materials we can make available on basis to alert folks of those concerns. If you would share those.
I was never aware that the Central Yukon reached to the North Slope, but maybe I didn't see the right.
For the record, Representative, the Central Yukon Plan covers 53 million acres. 13 of it is federally owned. 40 million of it is state owned.
Wow. Thank you. Director Mage, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your presentation. And Commissioner, just want to ask for your input here. Noticing our time, we have about 15 minutes left in this meeting. Would it make sense to have Director Ellis? That might be a quicker one that we could complete for Division of Parks and potentially Support Services. That would isolate all of our oil and gas discussion for our meeting on Friday, maybe compartmentalize those topics fairly well. Would that work okay with you?
Yes.
Okay. So then on the phone, I believe we have Director Ellis. And in our packet, then we would be transitioning to page 17.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Ben Ellis. I'm the Director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. And yes, we're on slide 17. I look forward to seeing many of you that have worked with this session, and those that I haven't that are new, welcome. And I look forward to talking about parks more in depth with you as the session moves forward. As many of you know, Alaska is very blessed with beautiful scenery, beautiful land, and we have the largest state park system in the nation. In fact, we have the largest state park in Wood Tipchick, 1.6 million acres, and we have the third largest state park, and that's Chugach, with a just right at a half a million acres. You know, you can go through all kinds of statistics to talk about it, but, you know, we manage this with 177 full-time positions. We also look at and administer federal recreation grants and oversee a number of statewide programs, including boating safety, and the Office of History and Archaeology is part of this division as well. Moving to the next slide, just some things that we've accomplished in 2016 or in the last few years. I am looking forward to sending all of you an invitation to the opening of Kasugi Ken Campground in the South Denali Visitor Center Complex, which is up in near Representative Del Rico's neck of the woods. It's going to be a world-class campground. We'll talk more about it on Friday, but it's been 20 years since we opened the campground, and it will be providing revenue through not only the campsites, but the public use cabins and the trails that are being put there. I'd like to spend just a little bit of time talking about our continued initiative to reduce the Alliance and General Fund for State Park Operation. Just to kind of show you what we've done over the past few years, I'm very proud of it. In FY13, our program receipts, which are our fees, and that can be parking, camping, commercial use permits, etc., covered about 33% of our operational costs. By 2016, we'd moved it up to 37%. Last year, we were at 49% covering our operation costs, and we are projecting in FY2018 that we will cover more than 50% of our operational cost. And again, we'll talk about on Friday the things that are leading to that. And but our goal is to get the operational part of our program close to being self-sufficient. And I think this all kind of addressed what Representative Dolson was talking about a little bit earlier. We're really excited about that, and I think, as I said, you'll hear more about that on Friday. One of our stellar programs is our boating safety program, and the amount of life jackets and the amount of children taught through the Kids Don't Float program is truly impressive. And today, that program, especially the loaner board and life jacket loaner board, is credited as saving 28 lives in Alaska. Other sort of significant facts about the division, we've issued 57 archaeological survey permits and review over 1,600 projects for impact historical properties. And this is an action that helps in exploration and development in a number of ways. And that is a primarily program funded by federal funds, same as the boating safety program is. And we awarded about $360,000 in historical grants and more than $1.4 million in recreational grants. And in those recreational grants, that includes federally funded the Recreational Trails Program, sometimes it's referred to as RTP, and then in snow track programs, which go to grooming trails and also for safety and education. You know, I'm very proud of the department, the division. I could speak on and on. I know we're at a short time crunch, so at this time, Madam Chairman, I will open it up for any questions that members may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Ellis. Do any members have questions for the director?
Just real fast.
Mr. Kocher.
Thank you, Kocher. Mr. Ellis, even though we're not working in our capacity as a budget subcommittee, my question for you, because these things sort of meld together, you talked about the trail grooming and snowpack work. That was obviously a veto that drew some ire, and I think it got the administration sort of solved it and put a patch on it. But is this where that grant came, or was it another source?
I'm thinking
of snow machining here.
Through the chair, yes, sir. That program is for snow machine grooming and for safety. Comes from a snow machine registration fee that the Department of Motor Vehicles takes, and then there was a always a sort of pass through that was in the budget that would turn that money over to parks to work on as I said, trail grooming and safety programs. That was eliminated last year in the budget. It is a program that is funded one year and is enacted the next year. So the money comes in, say the money from 2016 came in, and it is we use it in 2017. So at the present time, we're using the 2016 money, and in the proposed budget, I believe, the governor's budget, is to place that back in. So, yes, you're correct. That is the area that the snow machine grooming and safety program, how it's funded.
Thank you.
Director Ellis, this is Representative Tarr. Quick question. We changed some things last year that allowed you to have increased receipt authority, and that is going to allow you to do some merchandise expansion of selling of merchandise. And for the new members, I wondered if you could just briefly touch on that.
Yes, ma'am. Through the chair, I'll speak about that, I think, more in depth on Friday. But basically, there are many state parks throughout the nation that are able to sell park-themed merchandise to the public, and that helps offset their costs. There's at least six states that I call in the million-dollar-plus club, and that means they make a profit of $1 million or more. In fact, one makes $6 million a year in just sales of merchandise, and they usually do this through three venues. They do it through a wholesale opportunity to retail stores. They do it in their campgrounds or their areas, and they do it online. We sought and the legislature approved the ability for parks to sell park-themed merchandise for a profit last session. We have gone through, purchased, there was no fiscal note to that. We pulled some money together to have some seed money so that we do have a merchandise, both sweatshirts and t-shirts, for sale. We were able to put together a professional website where you can we can take credit cards and order, and we ship it out and so forth. We have seen somewhere around $20,000 in revenue generated just from this late fall, early winter, when we really were able to start going online. So it's an area that will take some growth. Those six states that I mentioned have had this program in place for about 10 years. But it is one of several funding sources that we're looking toward in the future so that we can continue to decrease our unrestricted general fund.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a follow-up question to yours, actually. It sounds wonderful. What can we do to promote that growth? How can we get to emulate those other states more rapidly? I guess I'm asking what can we do to help with that transition into a downright profitable parks department?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I sure appreciate your support there and enthusiasm. Unfortunately, there's one thing that I know that would help us, and that is something the state does not have at this time, and that is funding. For every state, if they make a $1 million profit, they put $500,000 of product out. If they make $2 million, it's right at, double. If you provide $1 million worth of product, you get about $2 million. $1 million in product, you get about $2 million back. So it's a matter of we're having to grow slowly, primarily because of the fiscal restraints the state has. We're on Facebook. We did a booth at the in Anchorage during the Christmas time. So we are trying to grow this program slowly but as quickly as possible. But we're not putting all of our eggs in this basket. We're looking at new camp areas like South Denali. We're looking at new public use cabins, which we can't build fast enough because of the popularity. We're looking at a number of profit centers that will get us past 50% toward more of the 75% self-sufficiency in the near future, sir.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Parrish?
Yes, and I apologize for using so much time, but through the chair. Director Ellis, you've asserted that we can have essentially 100% return on investment in these in this area. Is that... I'd love to see more about that.
Representative Parrish, the three legs of the stool that I talked about, selling wholesale, selling in parks, and selling online, Alaska, and that's where the three are the six states that do very, very well. That's the three legs of stool they have. Ours is going to fall more, I think, on the internet and online. Because unlike many states, we do not have areas where you drive through an infant station or a camp store, things where you can buy product, to when you're camping or when you're out, hiking or wherever. So our focus is going to have to be on the online part, and from talking to other states, that's the area that probably takes the most to develop and to grow, or the slowest to grow, I'll put it that way.
Thank you, Director. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Director Ellis, for your important presentation as well. And we're coming down to the last couple minutes. I will say we'll always be here until 3 o'clock, almost always. I will be willing to bet. Former Chairman Del Rico can attest to that, as well as Representative Josephson. And so we do have to take advantage of that time, take every minute we can. And in thinking ahead for Friday, that has allowed us to compartmentalize a little bit into our oil and gas and mining discussion. I hope we'll have enough time. However, I'm looking at our trust lands office person and thinking that there's been some recent news. And so please, if that's an area of interest for you, let's come Friday to get those questions answered as well, just because I know that'll be a precious 2 hours for us to be able to get through the remainder of your presentation. Co-Chair Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Deputy Commissioner Wiggins and Director Walsh. I know you're very busy, and we need you to be busy, and I appreciate you being here and flying down and indulging us to come back on Friday.
Okay, with that, seeing no further business, please bring your presentations again, the same presentation on Friday. And with that, we will go ahead and adjourn at 3 p.m.